President Trump is giving serious consideration to resuming full-scale war against Iran, calculating that he can finally finish the job. Apparently, he's been listening to a lot of the generals that we keep showing you on here, and there's some more senior officials that are coming out and telling you, don't worry, everything is going to be good because we have the escalation dominance, and it's those darn Iranians that you can't trust. We're going to try and divine weirdness from reality today, and there's nobody better to do that, especially where this stuff could be going and what the reaction could be if President Trump makes through. And that is John Mearsheimer, international relations theorist, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and a wise sage in all things foreign policy. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thank you for having me here, Danny.
Well, listen, I can see the kind of the smile on your face as even I was talking, because I'm sure you have some interesting things to say. I want to show you something that happened just a little while ago on Fox News. A former Trump administration official from the first time, Robert Greenway, was being asked about what is going on with this situation, because obviously with the Houthis have closing down the Bab al-Mandab, adding to the problems, have attacked Saudi ships. The Strait of Hormuz is still closed. Oil prices continuing to rise, and actually it's accelerating here even today. It's gone up quite a bit. But according to Robert Greenway, we don't have anything to worry about. Everything is going to be fine.
The Iranians have proven once again they can't be trusted to pursue a diplomatic approach. They can't abide by any agreement. And so having closed that, the president is compelled to resume military operations and escalate, not only to restrict their capacity to disrupt shipping in the Straits of Hormuz, but also the ballistic missile capacity that struck our troops in Muwafaq al-Sati in Jordan over the weekend. And in the end, I think what we can be encouraged by is that Iran has very little capacity and capability left. And if they escalate, the United States has rungs in the ladder which are completely beyond the reach of Iran and their surrogates in Yemen, Ansar Allah, or the Houthis, which you'll recall were striking up to a dozen vessels a day at one time until the United States launched a sustained campaign to reduce their capability, which could be in the offing as well.
Right. That's good right there, Gary. We'll stop it right there. A number of things. What do you make, first of all, of the statement that because Iran can't be trusted and they don't meet any of their obligations, President Trump is, the word he used, compelled to ratchet this up. What do you say?
I think he's dead wrong. It's the Americans who can't be trusted. If you look at the 17 June Memorandum of Understanding, and the key issue here involves Article 5, who controls the Strait of Hormuz. In my opinion, Article 5 makes it clear that it is Iran that will be in control of the Strait of Hormuz for the 60-day negotiating period. And after that, the future of the strait will be decided between Oman on one side and Iran on the other side. The United States is not mentioned at all. And what the Trump administration tried to do after the Memorandum of Understanding was signed was create a channel in the Gulf, or to put it more specifically, to create a channel in the Strait of Hormuz that basically was American controlled and would allow ships to go through under the auspices of the United States and outside the auspices of the Iranians. And unsurprisingly, the Iranians said this was unacceptable and that it was a violation of Article 5 of the Memorandum of Understanding. The Iranians are correct. What that gentleman just said on Fox News is simply not true.
And so what about his comment there that we should be encouraged that President Trump has a resolution to this? So even though Iran is not doing what we want them to, forget about what the MOU actually said, but don't worry because we have escalation dominance, do we?
Well, you want to remember that President Trump signed the Memorandum of Understanding on June 17th because he had no choice. The Iranians were winning the war, and the Iranians held all the cards when you went up the escalation ladder. And this is why President Trump signed what was effectively a surrender document. Now, the question you have to ask yourself is what's changed since June 17th that now gives us escalation dominance? I mean, if we had had escalation dominance before June 17th, we would have taken advantage of that and we would have used it to make sure we got a better agreement. The fact that we didn't take advantage of it meant we didn't have escalation dominance before June 17th. So the argument here is that something has changed. Well, I'd like to know, what is that something that has changed? According to my calculations, we've been engaged in this tit-for-tat strategy since July 7th. Again, the Memorandum of Understanding was signed June 17th. We then welched on the deal, and you got this tit-for-tat strategy starting on July 7th, which is now taking place. And it does not look like it. We have gained any coercive leverage over Iran as a result of that tit-for-tat strategy. They are matching us at every turn and causing us huge trouble in the Gulf. We don't have escalation dominance. Now, is the administration saying that we can escalate further? We can go beyond tit-for-tat, maybe go back to the 40-day war, which was a real strategic bombing campaign that took place between February 28th and April 8th. We can go back to that, and we'll win that conflict. I don't think so. There's no evidence we can do that. And there's no evidence that continuing tit for tat, even at a higher level, is going to produce the desired outcome for the United States. The fact is, we have no choice but to reach some sort of memorandum of understanding with the Iranians and put an end to this.
And look, there is some real immediate present term costs to going down this path. You mentioned that on June 17th, even Trump admitted that there were some economic potentials. Well, now that we're seeing, what you're seeing on the screen right here is the live actually spot price for a barrel of oil. It's $140. The paper price right now, the futures market, is, I think it's 92 for WTI and right around 100, I think, for Brent. But when you're actually buying a barrel of oil, that's what you're paying right now. And the expectation is that as the time goes forward, these two sides are going to merge. So you're going to get closer to this number here is actually going to be what we have to pay. I mean, we are paying it right now. So the question is, financially, what has changed from June 17th to today when you see what we're actually paying?
What has happened is the situation has gotten much worse economically. And the key factor here is the fact that the Houthis have shut down the Red Sea. They now make it impossible for Saudi Arabia to ship its oil through Bab el-Mandab Strait. And this is going to have significant negative effects on the price of oil and therefore on the international economy. This is, in my opinion, a disastrous situation. The Strait of Hormuz is shut down, and now the Bab el-Mandab Strait is shut down. So economically, we're worse off today than we were right after June 17th. Second point I'd make to you, Danny, is, as you know, one of the reasons that we wanted to reach an agreement with the Iranians is that we were running out of precious munitions. This is one of the reasons that we ended our war against the Houthis in the spring of 2025. It's one of the reasons that we were so anxious to end the 12-day war against Iran last June. This is June 2025. It's one of the reasons that we wanted to stop the 40-day war, as I said. And as you engage in a tit-for-tat strategy, you're using up more precious ammunitions. So for those people who talk about escalating now, you want to remember that what we're going to do is burn up even more precious munitions. So from that point of view, as well as from the economic point of view, it makes no sense for us to up the ante or to continue the status quo with regard to this tit-for-tat strategy. What we should do, if we were smart, is cut a deal.
Yeah, we already had a deal and we uncut it, to use that vernacular here. But this seems to complicate situations. So you mentioned that the Houthis, Ansar Allah, has closed the southern exit to the Red Sea at the Bab el-Mandab, and that has caused the oil price to spike even higher than it was just because of the Strait of Hormuz. In response, yesterday, President Trump said, please let this truth serve to represent that if they do this again, the U.S. will hold Iran responsible and that the Houthis are a surrogate and a proxy and a major military punch will be inflicted. But at least as of right now, we have done nothing for the Houthi attack onto Saudi vessels. Gary, I think, has some video where you can see a pretty spectacular nighttime scene, one of those ships on fire. And at least so far, we've done nothing. Do you expect that to continue?
Danny, we went to war against the Houthis in March of 2025. This is a year ago this past March, right? President Trump comes into the office January 2025. In March, 2 months later, he goes to war against the Houthis. He quits in May because he can't defeat the Houthis. And furthermore, as I said before, we were expending precious munitions. What's changed now? Does he really want to go to war against the Houthis as well as Iran? I don't think so. He's not going to defeat the Houthis. He's not going to defeat Iran. And he's going to end up expending even more munitions than he's now expending in his fight against Iran. So we have no cards to play with regard to the Houthis.
And yet, according to Greenway there just a second ago, and when you take a look at even Al Jazeera is reporting that Jordan, Bahrain, and Kuwait have reportedly received retaliatory strikes from Iran after our 12th consecutive. So earlier today, the Iranian side clearly is not backing down anything. But then that second bullet you see at the bottom, President Trump is considering a massive attack on Iran, bigger than ever before, and that he's close to making a decision. But, you know, let's take a look at here's what's been happening just recently with all of these American bases getting hit already. And like, look, Greenway said something that lots of other people are saying, which is just crazy to me. He said they don't hardly have any capacity left. And yet this confirms they do have a lot of capacity. That's just over a single 7 day period. And there's more after that. And then you see just overnight, earlier this very day, those targets are hit and there's nothing we can do to stop them. What does that tell you about our defensive capability?
Well, the American intelligence community has made it clear that as a result of the 40-day war, Iran was left with a substantial number of missiles and drones, and they're continuing to replenish their capability when it comes to missiles and drones. So there's no evidence that I know of that Iran is running out of missiles and drones. I mean, people like Greenway can make these assertions, but you have to back these assertions up with facts. You have to be able to show us the evidence that Iran is running out of missiles and drones. In fact, what we see with our own eyes is exactly the opposite of what he says. One more point on this, Danny. He talks about how President Trump is going to up the ante. We're going to escalate, and that's going to, you know, provide the magic formula. But it's easy to say things like that. Please tell us what your theory of victory is. Tell us exactly what we're going to do when we escalate. What targets are we going to hit? And what effect is hitting those targets going to have on the Iranians? Nobody ever tells us that story because, in fact, there's no story to be told. What targets can we hit that will make a difference? The answer is none. If there were those targets, we would have hit them a long time ago. It's not like we've just been waiting for the right moment to hit the targets and bring the Iranians to their knees. This is a ludicrous argument. There is no set of targets that we can hit that will coerce the Iranians into surrendering. It's not going to happen. They are facing an existential threat. They're going to fight to the death. And they have lots of capability to do that. We are in a losing war. And again, this is why President Trump signed the Memorandum of Understanding on June 17th. And as I said before, nothing has changed since then. There's no magic formula available today that was not available on June 17th.
You know, it's interesting. You say nobody has answered that question of what is the attainable military objectives that will cause him to compel. I'm going to show you in just a second something from Marco Rubio where he does seem to say some of those words. I'll let you comment on what he says. But just to set the context here, yesterday, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said that our defense doctrine is clear. It's an eye for an eye. Any aggression against Iran, including our infrastructure, will compel a powerful and decisive response. Those who contribute to such an aggression, whatever kind of support, will also be considered legitimate targets. And that was, of course, validated this morning when Iran hit Kuwait and several other places here. But in response to Araqchi's making that statement, Marco Rubio dismissed it like this.
You know, guys, I saw Araqchi, their foreign minister, who the other day say or something about their policy is an eye for an eye. The president's policy is a head for an eye. I mean, honestly, that's what it's going to be. I mean, they will pay a very heavy price for the things they're doing. They're already paying a very heavy price. You guys don't know it because you don't cover it. You're not in Iran. You're not in the street. They don't have a free media. But they're going to continue to pay a very heavy price. Their industrial base has been decimated. Their defense industrial base has been decimated. They're losing launchers. They're losing radars every single night. They are suffering billions of dollars in damage, and their economy is a disaster. But despite all that, okay, these people who are calling us every day, begging, let's do a deal. They send us messages through other countries, third countries. I mean, they're running out of countries to send. Even I had countries here coming up to me. Oh, I just spoke to the Iranians. They want to do a deal. The problem is every time these people do a deal, they either break it or after they make it, they want to change the deal.
So he's talking in the we'll get the second part in a minute. But that first part, he's talking about, you know, how their economy is in shambles, how their industrial capacity has been shambled and taken down. Gary, if you can pull up that Central Command video you've shown before, where it shows the targets that we're hitting. I want to make a comment on that, because he's talking, Secretary Rubio there, saying basically, look, we're hitting their economy, we're hitting their industrial capacity, we're hitting their ability to wage war. So the implication is all we got to do is just do that a little bit more, and then we're going to have success here. And the reason I ask him to pull this up, because you can see what these, okay, so there's a couple of speedboats just sitting tied up there. There's some other targets. It's not, okay, there's a single boat. It looked like a rowboat, actually more than a military craft. But then you look at some of these others, like, I don't even know for sure. This is some kind of truck of some sort. I don't know. But what I don't see there, and any of these other ones that are shown too, is this right here. I haven't seen any attacks on the only thing that really matters, is that is in these underground missile cities where they launch the long-range missile system, the long-range drones, and where they have their manufacturing well away from our ability to hit it. So if Rubio says that with words, but it's not matched in actual deeds, then it seems kind of weird that we would base policies off something that therefore cannot succeed. But it seems like that's what we're about to do.
Well, Danny, the fact is the United States, first with sanctions and now with this war, has done enormous damage to the Iranian economy. Nobody denies that. That's a basic fact. It's been true for a long period of time. The question you have to ask yourself is, can you damage that economy enough to get the people to rise up and overthrow the government, or cause the government to say enough is enough, we quit? And the historical record is actually quite clear on this. We've seen bombing campaigns in World War II and the Korean War and the Vietnam War that were far more extensive than this bombing campaign. And in all those cases, the target state did not surrender. These kind of punishment campaigns don't produce victory. And it's no accident that if you ramp back to February 28th and then you come forward to the present, all of the destruction that we've wrought on the Iranian economy has not come close to getting them to quit. So what is the administration going to do in terms of hitting particular targets to change this situation? President Trump occasionally talks about going after bridges and power stations and the oil network or the oil installations inside of Iran. But he hasn't done that yet. And that means that we still could do much more damage to the Iranian economy. But the question you have to ask yourself is, number one, will that make them quit? And number two, what will they do in retaliation? Because that's a very important matter here. And the fact is, even if you go in and you tear up their bridges and their power stations and so forth and so on, they're still not going to quit, because they face an existential threat and they're not going to submit to this existential threat. They'll fight to the last person. And again, the historical record is very clear on this. Second, they're going to retaliate. And they're going to do enormous damage to the Gulf states, to Jordan, and maybe even to Israel. They have a formidable capability. They have lots of missiles. They have lots of drones. And they know how to use them in sophisticated ways. So I don't think that escalating is going to produce victory. And again, I don't think Rubio or any of these other proponents of escalation tell a plausible story about how escalation produces victory. Their basic view is we just got to get tough. We just have to escalate. And that will produce victory. That's the story. We've already done a lot of damage. Just do some more damage. That'll produce victory. Those are kind of vacuous statements. When you're in a war and you're thinking about how to win that war, you have to think about what the concrete steps are that you're going to take. And then you have to be able to tell a plausible story about how those concrete steps allow you to achieve your objectives. And nobody does that because they can't.
Now, they can't. And so what they do instead is what Rubio did in that the last part of that clip there, which he repeated something that President Trump has been saying ad nauseum almost throughout this whole thing. And that is that Iran is begging us for a deal. Meanwhile, all the public statements, they say the opposite, that they're not going to do any deal at all until we submit to their conditions and their terms, which were still in the 14 points, which we haven't done. So how much longer can it work? Is it working now on the American public? Are they going to continue to believe these statements that Iran is just begging for a deal?
I think the American public just doesn't matter here. I think the only thing that matters is the international economy from an American point of view. I think we're now getting to a danger point when you see the Brent cost of a barrel up around $100, and people are talking about maybe $120, $150 a barrel. This is a real sign of danger. And I think that's what matters the most. I don't think whether or not the American public believes the Iranians or believes President Trump about who wants peace really matters much at all. I think it's the price of oil that matters. And of course, that will matter for the public and cause President Trump all sorts of problems. So the public matters in that sense, but not otherwise.
Can the chief diplomat continue to say those kinds of things? And because obviously it's being heard in the Gulf GCC countries. It's being heard in Tehran. It's being heard in Saudi Arabia, for example, and we can talk about some issues with that here in just a second. But is there a cost to this, or does everybody just go, yeah, I see his mouth moving, I'm not listening to anything, it doesn't matter? Is there a cost to saying things that are self-evidently untrue?
Not anymore, because everybody knows that Trump and Rubio say things that are clearly not true all the time. I think the Gulf states fully, or the leaders in the Gulf states, I would even imagine the publics in the Gulf state fully understand that the Iranians are not begging for peace, and that the Iranians are committed to this fight for the long term, and they are going to execute an eye for an eye strategy. So Rubio and Trump can say all these outrageous things, but people just roll their eyes and they understand, like you and I do, what's going on here. That may not be so true in the West, but in terms of the Gulf, I think it is true.
Well, let's take a look at what do people think of it here? Because you mentioned that, you know, now that people are seeing the price of oil is going up, the price of gasoline is not coming down. In fact, it started going back up now. And now then with this issue with Ansar Allah and the Bab al-Mandab, this was in the Politico yesterday, a politically impossible situation. New poll shows Trump voters losing patience with the war. And if I can avoid that weirdness on my computer screen, you roll up here and you see that where did that one go? See, it's a precipitous 13-point drop in just 2 months, according to this poll, reveals how the president's most diehard supporters are starting to agree with the majority of Americans who have long opposed the U.S. involvement in the war. Does the fact that it's now President Trump's supporters, might that move him to do something that makes more sense?
Again, I don't think that's of critical importance. I think that President Trump just understands that he cannot afford a protracted war here because of the effects it will have on the international economy. We already see evidence of that. but also because of the munitions situation that we were talking about before. I mean, I'm just not sure that public opinion matters that much in this case. The question for him is just what can he do to end this war on favorable terms? And the fact is he can't do that. The other thing, Danny, and I just want to point this out, I think from an Iranian point of view, the longer this war goes on, the better, because the longer it goes on, the more coercive leverage they have. If you look at what's happening to the price of oil, this is in Iran's interest. And if the war goes on for a couple more weeks and oil goes up and up and up and hits $150 a barrel, $200 a barrel, that's to Iran's advantage. It gives them coercive leverage. And with regard to escalation, you know, Trump officials can argue that we're going to escalate and we're going to punish the Iranians and this will give us a war-winning strategy. I think exactly the opposite is the case. I think if they escalate, if the administration escalates and the war becomes more intense, that this will play to Iran's advantage because it will cause economic havoc, more economic havoc in the Middle East. And economic havoc, I believe, works to Iran's advantage. As I've said before, I think you can make an argument that Iran was foolish to sign the Memorandum of Understanding on June 17th. They should have just let the war go on hoped that the United States did foolish things that made the price of oil go up further and further. And of course, this is what's happening now. The price of oil is going up. And again, this works to Iran's advantage. So I don't think Iran has any great incentive to put an end to this war quickly. I think if anybody's talking to the Omanis and the Pakistanis about trying to restart the negotiation process, I bet it's the Americans, not the Iranians.
Dan, you got to bring yourself in.
Or else it's the Saudi Arabians or the Qataris, all kinds of Kuwaitis people. They may be the ones that are saying, hey, let's find a way to get out of this because it's really costing them a lot. Saudi Arabia finally is starting to pay a bigger financial cost than some of the others have up through the first part of this with the closure of the Bab al-Mandab. But let me ask you a very specific question. What, given all that has happened and all the conditions you've mentioned with the interceptor missiles, our offensive missiles, Iranian, you know, mountainous the missile cities, et cetera, what can Trump do now? Not what should he do, because you've already answered that. He should just walk away. But what, given his political constraints, where can he go if he recognizes, as you suggest, that he recognizes this problem, he's got to get out? How can he do it using Trumpian capabilities?
Well, he's going to have to cut a deal. And what he's going to try to do is convince people that it was the Iranians who wanted to go back to the negotiating table and that he's accommodating them. This is reflected in Rubio's rhetoric, which, of course, is rhetoric the president uses all the time. You know, what we're saying here is that it's the Iranians who want to go back to the negotiating table. Why are they pounding on that message? It's because we want to go back to the negotiating table, but we don't want to be seen as the one that's desperate to get back to the negotiating table. Then we'll go back to the negotiating table and we'll spin whatever agreement is reached as a great victory. Trump, of course, tried to do this on June 17th. But he couldn't convince the hawks of that, and they basically pushed him to welch on the deal. This time, I think Trump's going to get a worse deal than he got on June 17th. Because again, as I said before, the Iranians have more coercive leverage the longer this war goes on. So the second time you go to the negotiating process, they're going to have more leverage. They're going to drive a tougher bargain. So he's going to have a more difficult time trying to convince people that this is not another surrender document. In other words, an even worse surrender document. But he'll try to do that. He'll try to say, you know, we've put an end to the war. We've solved the economic crisis and we're going to live happily ever after. Will he be able to sell that? I doubt it, but he'll try.
You know, what it appears to me is, and as you're talking here, I'm kind of putting some, connecting some dots potentially, that maybe that is why he's saying that. That's why Rubio was saying that. But that he's like, all right, to sell that, I first have to do one more big push. And that could be the reason why Jack Keane said this.
We are on a definite path to return to major combat operations that would involve Israel and the United States. I think that is the path we're on. Is there some negotiations that the Iranians want to do here? Of course. They want to negotiate. Why now? They want to negotiate because they want to stop the United States from imposing their will by firing on them and taking away their military capabilities. They want to stop that, as they did successfully back on April the 7th and April the 8th. They want to replay that. I don't believe that's going to happen. Pakistanis and Qataris are supporting him on that, but I don't think that's where the president is and his team around him. I believe where they are frustrated. They want to get the Straits of Hormuz eventually open and also return to major combat operations and finish what they started out to do in terms of assigned military objectives.
Now, you pointed out a second ago, I don't have to ask you the same question twice, all of these expansive list of objectives and things Jack Keane thinks we can accomplish, he doesn't ever provide a path to how we're going to get that done when it all failed during the first phase of this war, which you so clearly articulated last time with the 40-day bombing phase, the blockade phase, and then the MOU phase, and now then we're trying to find a new phase, I guess. Do you think that it's possible that President Trump is putting out stuff like this, and like what Greenway said, and like what Keith Kellogg said also, that we want to try one more big push and then we can somehow claim after the smoke clears that we caused Iran to make a deal?
Could be the case, Danny. I wouldn't be surprised. They're desperate and they're looking. I think they're looking for a way to end this war, yet be able to spin a story that we prevailed, the Iranians didn't prevail. And you could make an argument that what they're trying to do, and I'm not saying there's a lot of hard evidence to support this. This is, you know, based on deduction by you and me. You could make a case that they're setting up a story that says that it's the Iranians who want to go back to the negotiating table. They're desperate. Enormous damage has been done to them. And then what we do is we go out and we slam them. Over the next couple days, and then we in effect declare victory and say we're ready now to go back to the negotiating table. And we hope that the Iranians feel the time is here to negotiate another memorandum of understanding. And then that deal is done. And then we say it's not a surrender document. We actually prevailed. And the reason we prevailed is we got tough with the Iranians. And we were probably overly patient, but nevertheless, we, in the end, brought down the hammer on them and they conceded. That's a plausible way of getting out of it from their perspective. The question is whether they can convince the rest of us that this is what really happened. And I think that's going to be almost impossible to do. They'll try to tell a story that we won, but I don't think that you can tell that story. I mean, when you go down what the list of demands were going into this war, and the fact that we didn't achieve any of them, and then you look at the other downsides that have resulted from this war, what the world looked like on February 27th compared to today. Forget the demands we made, just, you know, who controls the Strait of Hormuz, what's happened to our basing structure in the Gulf, what's happened to our alliance structure in the Gulf, what's happened to our munitions supply, and so forth and so on. This is really a devastating defeat for the United States. How can anybody miss that? But they'll try to spin a story, assuming we're correct in what they're up to, that portrays us as the winners and the Iranians as the losers.
And, you know, I have to wonder, so we had the deal that you say Trump needs to try to get now in our hands. with the MOU. So in June, President Trump made the statements that you just articulated a second ago. He acknowledged, he recognizing the potential. None of those things have changed. They're all there now. And yet, for some reason, he still gummed it up with this trying to change the terms in the southern part of the Strait of Hormuz with the Omani corridor. Then now this 12 straight days we've attacked them, et cetera. Probably a 13th day is coming later today. Maybe something even bigger. We'll see what's going to happen. But let's say that he does do what we have just speculated he may. And then after some big hit or whatever claim, we're going to walk away. We'll be in a worse position on the other side of all this if Iran agrees to anything. And what's to say he's not going to do it again and gum that one up? I mean, why would he abide by the over there with worse terms than he did on June 17th with the terms he had?
Well, the problem that he faces is that the munitions crisis and the situation with regard to oil prices is reaching the point where he just has to reach some sort of agreement that he sticks to. He just can't keep doing this. I don't think he can fight a forever war here. If you think about Afghanistan, you think about Iraq, think about Vietnam, think about those forever wars. The international economy was not affected in any meaningful way as a result of those wars. We weren't talking about taking the international economy off a cliff during the Afghanistan war. And in terms of munitions, none of those conflicts really ate up precious American munitions the way the Iran war is doing. So this is a very different situation, and he has to shut this one down. And by the way, we haven't even talked about the midterm elections, which really do matter to him, and which this war has consequences for. You showed the poll data before about what's happening to his support inside the MAGA movement. And this is not good news for the president when it comes to the midterm elections. So that matters too. So this one, I think, has to be shut down at some point in time. I just don't think it can go on and on.
You know, and it's not a surprise. But the administration is sabotaging its own potential. If they were going down that path, then they would be saying things that are different, that are supportive of that. But instead, in Senate testimony, here is Pete Hegseth talking about how weak the Iranian side is.
Iran is at the weakest point militarily it has ever been in the past decade, certainly maybe in 47 years, as they've gathered effectively a terror army. So well, I acknowledge clearly, they still have capabilities, no doubt. But the amount of damage that we've done to them over the course of these series of operations has put them in the worst place they've ever been.
How can you make that argument in the worst place they've ever been when we just showed you this just the last few days? They keep hitting this stuff. I mean, how can anyone plausibly make that statement? I mean, how does anybody believe in it?
Well, I would just note that what's been happening since the tit for tat strategy started on July 7th is that the Iranians have been targeting all of our military installations in the Gulf, and they have been destroying them. And we, therefore, have retreated in very important ways to Jordan. And the reason that Jordan has become a target, remember, early in the war, Jordan was not a target at all. The target set that the Iranians were going after was exclusively in the Persian Gulf. Well, now Jordan is a big fat target for the Iranians. Why is that the case? Because we're moving our military capability out of the Gulf to Jordan. And now the Iranians are basically going after our military capabilities and our infrastructure in Jordan and forcing us back to Israel. And at the same time, there's no evidence they're running out of missiles and drones. So how somebody like Pete Hegseth can argue that the Iranians are weaker than ever and we have them right where we want them is an argument I just don't understand how he can make. It's just palpably untrue. It's obvious from what's going on that the Iranians are in an excellent position from a military point of view. And that we have no way of eliminating their military capability. And by the way, Danny, it's also important to emphasize that the Russians and the Chinese are clearly helping them. I think not only with intelligence, but also with weaponry. I believe that the Iranians are receiving help from the Chinese and the Russians that's making their weapons much more deadly. And that's causing us huge problems. So I think that Hegseth here is just blowing smoke.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of those chickens coming home to roost, which we've been doing against Russia for all these years. And, you know, I know you have some views on this in China, but, you know, given all these weapons to Taiwan all this time, it's not surprising that they're going to both do something against us. Actually, the only thing I've been surprised at is that it's taken this long for them to get to it, especially the Russians. Speaking of the Russians, there was Marco Rubio met with Sergei Lavrov yesterday. And interestingly, the readout on the American side was merely that a meeting took place and that they talked about the Russia-Ukraine war. That's it. It was like two sentences long, very short. But on the Russian side, Dmitry Peskov was asked this morning how the Russians view that.
In this situation, I wouldn't be overly optimistic. Contacts are indeed taking place. That is always positive. That is always positive. But one cannot speak of any new dynamics or acceleration right now. Now, we continue our dialogue with the Americans through existing working channels. And we hope that when the American negotiators are freer, we will continue in-person communication. They will be able to come to Moscow and continue our dialogue.
Now, the Russians have said of late, Sergei Lavrov and Vladimir Putin both, that they are very disappointed that the spirit of Anchorage from Trump's the first time when he had the rolled out the red carpet is effectively dead and there's nothing more to it. So why do you suppose that Sergei Lavrov would agree to meet Rubio, and what do they actually expect to happen?
I think that he met with him because he wants to show that he is a responsible diplomat who's open to diplomacy. He's willing to meet with the American Secretary of State. This all shows that Russia is a responsible actor, a responsible stakeholder in the international system. But in terms of actually expecting anything from the Americans, the Russians at this point in time don't expect anything from the Americans. They know that you can't trust Marco Rubio or President Trump any further than you can throw them. These are people who speak out of both sides of the mouth, who reach agreements and then violate those agreements. The Russians understand that they're basically at war with the United States, and what they have to do is go to great lengths to make sure that the United States loses in Iran. That's in Russia's interest. And furthermore, that Russia wins in the Ukraine war, and that Russia delivers the United States twin defeats. This is what the Russians are thinking, for sure. You want to remember, Danny, that at the G7 meetings that President Trump attended in France, the members of the G7 said afterwards in a declaration that they were going to accelerate their assistance to Ukraine in its waging of the long-range drone campaign against Russia. And furthermore, they made it explicit in the declaration that they were going to ramp up efforts to damage the Russian economy. This is the G7 countries, including the United States of America. Then you had, in early July, the NATO meetings at Ankara. And again, President Trump was there, and again, he and the NATO allies made it clear that they still had their gun sights on Russia, and they were going to do everything they could to make sure that Ukraine lost, that Russia lost in the Ukraine war, and would hopefully be weakened to the point where it was knocked out of the ranks of the great powers. This is what the United States is up to. Despite what President Trump or Marco Rubio says from time to time, it's quite clear that we have our gun sights on the Russians, and the Russians fully understand that, and they will act accordingly, which is not to say that you won't get this occasional diplo speak from people like Sergei Lavrov, because this kind of soft power is in Russia's advantage.
And speaking of the war there, because I think it's the most likely outcome is going to be the literal inverse of what you said the U.S. had hoped to do, which was to knock Russia out of the power, out of the ranks of the great powers. We may end up knocking ourselves out. But I want to look at something more on the operational, not the granular level so far. So far up to this point, but there has been over the last month or so, one of the major themes in the Western media was been a turning point has been achieved. Now then, because of these long range strikes and like into the wild berries, they're basically their Amazon supply chains, whatever, big, huge, spectacular fires, black smoke everywhere, refineries being hit, other military targets deep inside of Russia. And apparently Russia is not able to stop them. That's the implication. So a turning point has been reached. But then here in just the last week or 10 days, we saw that all of a sudden Ukraine has fired their prime minister, they fired their defense minister, and now they fired their general commander, General Sursky. So what do you make of all these turnovers? Because if you're winning, seems like that would be a bad time to overturn these key players.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that. When you see Sursky and the defense minister both fired, you just sort of say to yourself, wow, you don't want to do this in the middle of a war unless you absolutely have to. My sense as to what was happening here is that there was a fight between the defense minister and Sursky that involved strategy for the war. When the defense minister was appointed about 6 months ago, he more or less had two missions. One was to deal with the manpower problem. As we both know, the Ukrainians have a huge manpower problem. They have so many draft dodgers and so many people who are in the wall that they just don't have enough fighting forces up on the front lines. And the new defense minister was supposed to solve that problem. And in addition, he was going to go to work on the long-range drone attacks against against Mother Russia. Now, what happened is that he did not solve the manpower problem. The manpower problem is worse than ever. In fact, the last time I was on the show, I believe you showed some clips of riots in the western part of Ukraine, in the city of Lviv. So the defense minister did not solve that problem. And that causes problems for Sursky, because he needs increased numbers of troops. The other thing is, I think that there is a tension between waging a long-range drone war deep into Russia on one hand, and number two, employing large numbers of drones on the front lines. And I think the emphasis on using long-range drones that the defense minister favored was causing problems for Sursky up on the front lines. So Sursky was facing two problems. One, he wasn't getting enough troops. The manpower problem wasn't coming close to being solved. And number two, I think that you have a finite number of drones, and he was having trouble getting his fair share of those drones, because there was so much interest in the long-range drone campaign. And I think those sort of strategic or military considerations caused lots of tension between the two of them. They had two different strategies in mind on how to wage the war. One emphasized the long-range drone program, and the other, or long-range drone campaign, and the other fighting up on the front lines. And I think that led to significant tensions between the two of them. They might not have liked each other on personal grounds anyway, and you got a real conflict going here. And Zelensky ended up in a situation where he had to fire both of them. He fired the defense chief first, but that caused all sorts of protests because people really liked the defense chief. And I think that's in large part because they thought the long-range drone campaign was a winning strategy. And furthermore, it did not involve Ukrainian casualties. Whereas Sirsky, because he's up on the front lines and huge numbers of Ukrainians are being killed on the front lines, he's not going to be very popular compared to the defense minister. So I think in the end, Zelensky really ended up in a situation where he had no choice but to fire both of them. And this is not a good situation.
It's not a good situation. And I think, as we have both concluded, it's not going to make any difference who is in those positions. And whoever they replace them with, it's not going to be any more successful. In the last bit of time we have here, I wonder if you can tell us the collusion, I guess, between these two, or the nexus between these two wars in the Middle East and here, and what the impact on what we've discussed earlier on the Iran war could have here. Because if Zelensky has been begging, he wants a Patriot interceptor, a factory built there. He said they're going to do something that's years down the road. But they're at war right now. They're already having, again, to look at what's going to happen energy wise for the winter, and are they going to be able to survive that again? But now then, there's going to be even fewer air defense missiles available because we're burning through them at all. We're not going to have any to give to them at all, and maybe not even any of the longer range missiles, et cetera. And with the price of oil going up and the price of everything concurrently going up as well, we're going to be focused on trying to get that solved. What impact is that going to have on the actual conduct of this war?
Well, I'm basically from the Ted Postal school when it comes to talking and thinking about defensive missiles. I'm not sure those Patriots were doing much anyway. I mean, the implication of the discourse about the Patriots is that if the Ukrainians were able to get their hands on large numbers of Patriots, they'd be able to shoot down the vast number of ballistic missiles and cruise missiles and drones that the Russians are targeting Ukraine with. I actually don't believe that. But it's irrelevant because the fact is we don't have Patriot missiles to give to the Ukrainians. So they're not going to get the Patriot missiles. And there are no real meaningful substitutes here. So what you see, if you look at what's going on in Ukraine now, is that the Russians are pretty much free to attack any target in Ukraine, and they don't have to worry at all about a Patriot missile or any other kind of missile knocking down the incoming missiles or the incoming drones. So what you see is that Ukraine is highly vulnerable, and the Russians have a huge inventory of bombs and missiles and drones, and they are really pounding Ukraine. And I think most importantly at this point in time is the campaign in Odessa. And it looks to me like the Russians have basically cut off Odessa as a port of exit for Ukraine. Ukraine sells lots of its grain and wheat through Odessa, but that's no longer possible because the Russians have done so much damage to the port in Odessa. And I think what's happening here and is going to continue to happen is that the Russians are going to use their massive advantage in air power to continue to pound Ukraine. And this, coupled with the trouble that Ukraine is having on the battlefield because of its lack of manpower, I think guarantees that the Russians are going to win this war, number one. And number two, that Ukraine is going to emerge as a dysfunctional rump state.
Yeah.
So this is all disastrous for the Ukrainians.
And so let me ask you in like 30 seconds or less, what about the economics? Because everything in Ukraine is only kept alive because of European money. But with the disaster going on in the Gulf and the rising of the cost of energy, Russia's now getting more flush with cash because of the rise of that. And it's costing more to do business in Europe, and they're already pretty weak economically. Do you see any concerns about that in terms of how they can support going forward Ukraine?
Well, I think there's no question that what's happening in Iran is going to have a seriously negative effect on the price of oil and gas in Europe and cause big trouble for those economies. And I think the politics in Europe are likely to change over time and erode support for Ukraine in some important ways. And this means that Ukraine will get less help from Europe over time. You can already see evidence of that happening. And by the way, in terms of material support, this has already happened with the United States. So I think events in Iran and just the course of the war between Ukraine and Russia is creating a situation where Ukraine's future looks highly bleak.
Indeed. Couldn't put it better myself. Thank you so much for coming on today. Always a delight to have you on. We really appreciate it. And be sure to send people back to mearsheimer.substack.com to keep up with all the stuff that Professor publishes there. Always great stuff. I was looking at it just earlier today. Thank you so much for coming on. Always appreciate you.
Thank you for having me, Danny. My pleasure.
And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes more with former State Department official Matthew Ho. He's going to be taking a look at some things that are having to do with the U.S. Domestic issue, but as it relates to national security and foreign policy, it especially has to do with this whole issue of tying America's national security and intelligence to a third country. I bet you'll never guess which one it is. Join us today with Matt Ho here in just a few minutes on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.